This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Stephen Scott, Chair of ACAM and Professor of Child and Health and Behaviour at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London, where he is the Director of the National Academy for Parenting Research. Stephen is also a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital, where he specialises in children with conduct problems and those experiencing difficulty in the context of adopting and fostering. Stephen, welcome. Thanks for joining me. Can you start with an introduction?
Sure. So I trained as a paediatrician originally, but got a little bit bored sticking needles into premature babies. It was always the same three or four things that went wrong with them, and got interested in what happened to them when they grow up. Mm-hmm. And that led me to retrain in child psychiatry under a very godlike figure called Sir Michael Rutter, FRS, who trained us in rigorously asking hard questions about what the causes of children's difficulties were and whether what we were trying to do made any difference to them.
Thank you. You were awarded a CBE in the 2014 New Year's Honours List for services to families. And I'm wondering what initially prompted your interest in the field of family mental health. You said you started in paediatrics, but...
Yes. I think when I started in... I had done a first degree in psychology, which I found very interesting. So I always wanted to integrate those streams of children's psychological processes and well-being with a thorough understanding of what can go wrong. And I got interested in family and family processes because one of the teams I worked on used earbuds to try and coach parents directly to be more effective with their children. Mm-hmm. And I found that absolutely fascinating. And I think probably being brought up in a family where my parents said almost nothing to me, learning about, as it were, the grammar of conversations and relationships were personally interesting to me.
And was it effective, the earbuds?
Yeah, it was. In a very quick time, you could turn around families. So what I learnt was, and I firmly agree, I think one of the things I'm interested in is naughty, difficult, antisocial children. Mm. Who are often very neglected, particularly at the moment, and that actually by the original thinking was when I first started that you, as it were, laid them down on a couch and found out what was at the bottom of it, and that somehow that would be a great relief. It's what I call the pus model. You sort of get down there, lots of you go, oh, and they feel better and they're not naughty anymore. That's proven to be wrong for this condition in nearly all cases. Whereas if the way you handle them makes a lot of difference, that might sound obvious to you, but actually once a child's got very annoying, you stop spending positive time and investing in the relationship as a parent, they're just annoying. So changing that around, and then there's a big philosophical difference between saying, stop doing that, stop being messy, Stephen, do your homework, to actually saying, please keep your peas on the plate. You're training people up to where you do want them, you're giving them something in their mind's eye what they should be doing and saying, well done. Even the most naughty kids are behaving well 90% of the time. It's only occasionally they're having a tantrum or something. So I was very struck how you can turn around the actual behaviour, but also make the whole family atmosphere happier.
Right. You're director of the National Academy for Parenting Research, and you run a team that investigates how best to improve parenting to enhance child outcomes, which is what you've alluded to already. There are a number of exciting trials that are going on. Perhaps you could give a brief overview of some of these.
Sure. Well, we started off with the difficult cases that got referred to the Maudsley Hospital, but then it seemed to me we shouldn't just wait till things were so bad that they needed referral. So we did a trial in schools and with a fellow board member of ACAM, Professor Cathy Silver from Oxford, who is an educational specialist. Because it seemed to me if I went into school and said, oh, the teachers think your child is a dead ringer to become a drug dealer, may not be very appealing to people to turn up to a parenting class. But if we say, gosh, you tell us that they're quite difficult at home and the teacher's saying bad, do you know what's going on inside that classroom? Because we think by teaching you how to get a better relationship and how to read with your kid, these are 5 and 6 year olds, that can probably improve their life chances too. And we found that 2/3 of the parents who could come did turn up. We held them in schools and we taught them how to read with their kids, as I was saying. Sometimes basic stuff, turn off your mobile, turn off the telly, cuddle up. Right. Don't be too critical, just say, well done, I'm having a go at that word, rather than don't be stupid, Stephen, it's a cow. But we did show that after a year we'd improved their reading age by 6 months in 6 year olds, so that was quite useful. Oh,
so it has a cognitive impact as well as behaviour.
Yeah, and I think in a way children are our hope for the next generation of the future, aren't they? They're the new beautiful things, so getting that right can be very good, and most parents are very keen to improve their kids' outcomes. I think since then I've also got interested in measuring attachment, which, as you know, John Bowlby talked about in infants, but actually it seems to be an important concept in adolescence, and showing that those who are securely attached to their parents, using an interview rather than a behavioural test when they're separated from their mothers, did better, and how the active ingredient of parenting is sensitive responding with firm limits that promotes secure attachment. So that's been quite an exciting area to go. And I think one of the new developments which I find particularly interesting is that people now know if you're brought up, quotes, badly, that affects your body, your brain, your stress hormones. So there's now a link. There used to be sort of the old dualism between the mind and the body, but we now know actually if you're frightened, and it affects your hormones, it affects your brain structure. So it's coming together, which I find very exciting. Yeah. And perhaps disappointingly, if I go and see an MP or a minister and say, gosh, you know, bad parenting's bad for kids, and you know, they're more likely to go and become a criminal and hit their partners and be unemployed, they say yes. And I say, well, it affects their brain. Suddenly that becomes serious. There's something rather
physical aspect.
Physical seems to trump mental.
Always. Just looking at your research and in terms of the effectiveness of parent training, how effective is it in preventing the development of personality disorders or in mitigating their impact?
Yeah. Well, I think that's something very interesting, because the definition, and it's a slightly controversial term, a personality disorder, is that it's untreatable and you're fixed. It's kind of how you are. And there can be quite a genetic component to that. But nonetheless, I think we're able to show that there's one kind called so-called antisocial personality disorder, which includes kids who are rather psychopathic and rather nasty and calculating. They know what's going on if they upset somebody, but they don't care.
Right.
Unlike someone with, say, autism, who doesn't quite get it. And they're good at conning people, they can be superficially charming, they don't keep relationships because people sniff them out. But and there's a strong continuity to becoming an adult psychopath. So we did a trial and showed that amongst the very severe clinical ones, we could improve that.
Could.
So, so that was, I think, the first trial in the world to show that you can mitigate a personality disorder on core constructs.
Through parent training?
Through parenting programs, yeah.
And what age do you... Is there
We got in early. Yeah, I think there is, because these were between 4 and 8. Since then, I've done a couple of trials with adolescents, one using something called functional family therapy with young offenders, and another I was a part player in a big trial of something called multisystemic therapy. It had 680 participants, and we were all thrilled that it was going to be the great thing imported from America that works there. No effect. So whether that means adolescents are harder to treat, or whether it means that in the States, where they get almost nothing, the treatment as usual is pretty bad, they get chucked into jail and things like that, I don't know. But it was disappointing. I'd expected both of them to work. So on current British evidence, I would say get in early.
Right.
For this particular antisocial piece.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the resources and so on for that a bit later on. You mentioned attachment theory. You've just had a paper published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry that explores the financial consequences of insecure attachment in antisocial youth. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, I can. And this was interesting to me because we know that kids who display antisocial behaviour can be unhappy in lots of ways, but they then go on, particularly as they get into teenage, they start going out in gangs, they get their self-esteem from carrying drugs, selling them, saying, oh, when I really hit this person and I went and beat up that old lady, and they get brownie points, unfortunately, in their games for that. So I thought it might be just antisocial behaviour that means they cost society more in terms of special educational meetings, social services, ending up in A&E due to accidents. But even we did a thorough study where we control for those factors, but still those who are less securely attached, how much they felt when the chips are down, when they were ill, unhappy, frightened, could they turn to their parents for comfort? And the ones who couldn't cost even more. Now that might be because, yeah, they then acted out more when they were unhappy and they're less able to regulate their emotions. We couldn't look at the mechanisms. But one of the interesting things was that the attachment in this study to the father was even more important than to the mother in terms of how much they cost society if they didn't have it.
This is in terms of absent fathers or in terms of...
It doesn't matter where they're living, if they didn't have a secure attachment to their father. So, it would suggest that getting in... And we did another study where we showed that we looked at current quality of parenting, their sensitive responding in, this is 13 to 17-year-olds, and earlier. And I would have thought when you're asking about their parents and that, it would be pretty much predicted by whether they get on with their parents now. But to my surprise, the earlier quality of parenting was more important. So that does suggest that if you've had a good time earlier and you go through a bad patch now, the good time does count for something, you've got it inside.
Right.
But vice versa, if you've had a bad time earlier and you now kind of improve, it doesn't quite make up for lost time.
Is it explained through neurodevelopmental reasons? Or?
Who knows whether it's, you know, everything has got a nervous and neural connection. If I learn a new way of behaving, that's going to have something to do with what my brain is. So I wouldn't like to say, we are doing a study at the minute looking at whether parenting programs do change brain structure.
Oh, that's
but
really interesting.
We're just about to analyse that. Yeah.
Early days on that one. You've touched on this really already, but perhaps you could say a bit more about the human cost of insecure attachment. How does it manifest in children and young people in terms of their behaviour, their mental well-being, and their future life chances?
Yeah, I think it is important not to reify the attachment as a wonderful thing. One has to remember in terms of the patterns of secure or insecure, 30% or so of people have insecure attachment. So it's not that special. So a lot of the people are going around who function perfectly well. And they can be ambivalent. They can be very cross and annoyed with their parents, or some are just a bit more detached and avoidant and cut off, sort of a little English public school boys, whether they're boys or girls. I don't need you. I'll be self-contained. Mm. But the pattern that's particularly bad is the one that's so-called disorganised, where they fall to bits and really can't get it together and don't know where to turn. It's because if your parent is consistently rather dismissive, well, you're going to have to learn how to live with it. It's not ideal. But if they're sometimes warm, sometimes cold or neglectful, that's what seems to make it very hard. You don't know how to cope with them. And those ones do particularly badly in terms of their mental health, and they seem very unhappy too.
Mm. And parents with that disorganised attachment style, can they be trained in some way?
Well, that's... That's a very interesting area. So there is some relationship between if you're an insecure or disorganised parent, if you think relationships are not important, you then transmit that onto your children. You know, put yourself together, don't be stupid. You don't need to go to hospital for that. My sister once fell off a swing and said, "Oh, Mummy, I think I've broken my arm." My mother said, "Don't be so stupid." She'd broken her arm. So that would be a dismissive style. But the answer is, whatever the parent's attachment style is, you can teach them. We can all learn things. And I'm struck how it isn't just saying, oh, you really need to be better with your kid, but if you show videotapes of people doing it well and doing it wrong, or, for example, if you can take now, you can use people's phones to get a little two-minute clip of them with their child.
Mm-hmm.
And then to begin with, to get their trust, you say, look, that's really nice. You know, when Stephen, when you... say hello, Jojo smiles back, isn't that nice? You could do more of that. So you show what's going well, but then once you've got their trust and you can do this individually or in groups, you can say, well, gosh, you know, I noticed that when you Joe went off and had a little tantrum or didn't carry on doing her homework. So I'm struck how people will learn from that, whatever their own style. So it's not all written in stone, I think, is what I'm saying.
It's very exciting. What else is in the pipeline that excites you in terms of that type of work?
Well, I think the next thing that excites me is trying to make use of new digital technology, because we can never have enough staff. There is a tiny amount expended on child mental health. It's about £50 per year per outpatient. I mean, that's not a lot of money. One month of Sky Sports or BT Sports is about £60, so that's a 12th of what we pay for football. So it's not a lot of money, so I'm interested in trying to develop online apps. So I'm developing an online parenting program whereby people can look at it and make some progress on their own. The evidence is if you've got a person to report to, who they've met first, is going to ring them up and say, hello, how did you get on? That improves, as it would do with anything. Yeah. I can think I should go jogging, but if someone's going to come once a week and say, hello, have you been jogging? I'm more likely to do it. So that I find that very exciting. It may not be for everybody, but if 20 or 30% of the population who could benefit from it can do that. So I started off just thinking, yes, we'll put our little sensible tip sheets on the web. That was 5 years ago. We're still not there, because, of course, it's got to be very exciting. Mm. People leave health improvement websites in an average of 30 seconds.
Really?
So you've got to make it fun, engaging, quizzes, great videos, nice colours, the whole bit.
Right.
So that's taking a little time and money.
It's a work in progress, really.
Yeah, but I'm excited by that.
Sounds
it. Because I think in the end you want to get people to do it for themselves, don't you? Right. Not be told what to do by other people. Yeah.
So this is something that ideally that people would be able to access.
Free or for low cost.
For
sort of public health. It's a universal thing, not just for people experiencing difficulty.
You may have answered this already, but I'll ask it anyhow. Why is parenting research so important to child mental health development?
Well, it's a good question, because it might not be important. So I have a colleague at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience called Robert Plomin, who says within the normal range, most things are due to your genetics. And I just didn't believe that when I first did a psychology degree. I said, well, no, of course it's the way you're brought up. Look, I speak English, they speak German. The whole of your character. But it turns out that the kind of temperament you have is quite a bit genetically determined. So, for example, it's likely that you're more similar in your characters to your best friend than your sister or brother.
Okay,
that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
So you choose people. People have genetics. People vary genetically, is what I'm trying to say. But it is quite genetically determined. However, you can make quite a lot of difference.
Mm-hmm.
So antisocial behaviour, to go back to a previous point we're making about kids with callous, unemotional or psychopathic traits, even at seven, the antisocial kids who have that are 80% heritable. That's hugely, that's nearly all genetic. Whereas the more normal ones are just bit annoying and all the rest of it, and not heartless. It's only 30% genetic, so it's getting quite a sophisticated story. And you can have more effect probably in treating them or helping their parenting. They'll respond better if they don't have these callous and emotional traits. But so, why do I think it's important? It can make such a difference to people's lives, I suppose. And I've seen it, that's why I carry on as a clinician doing it, because I see it every week.
And as a clinician, I mean, what changes have you seen in terms of clinical practice and the way it's evolved over the years?
Yeah, I think it's more collaborative now. Mm-hmm. I think along with societal changes, people say, oh, I don't believe that, or why are you doing that, which is good, so it's much more equal.
Right.
There's less of an expert model. You're trying to negotiate their understanding of things and say, well, I think this, but what do you think, and how can we help? I think that's good. I think there's much more evidence.
Right.
There are about 680 randomised controlled trials in child mental health now, showing what works and what doesn't work.
Mm.
However, I still think there are some areas of non-progress. I think quite a lot of therapists do what they like doing, what they trained to do 30, 40 years ago, whether it works or not. I think that's almost a moral issue, because then if there are other things that are shown to work for a child, why are you doing things that don't work?
What's shown not to work then?
Some forms of individual therapy for antisocial behaviour, for example, for ADHD, generic supportive counselling for PTSD and things like that doesn't work. So you need both. You need to have a supportive relationship, but sometimes you need specific skills as well. So I think there's a difficulty getting people to do things that do work. I sometimes use the analogy, if you had appendicitis and you went into hospital, And the person said, oh, well, yeah, there's 98% chance if I cut out your appendix, it'll be fine, but I'm going to put some herbs in there and let's see what happens. You'd be quite fed up. So why is children's mental health not more important? Mm. So my answer to this is not to try as an expert to orate at people and lecture them, but we need to get parents clued up to, as you do, I mean, if you're buying... My son wants to buy a boombox this week, so you go and do a review of the different kinds of sound, waterproof things you can take into a park. But if you're going for something to help your child having some therapy, you should be finding out whether this works. You should be checking out the credentials of the therapist.
For the parent, sure.
Yeah, yeah, for their child.
Right.
It's important. People make enough fuss about schools, don't they? So why don't they do that when they're seeking child therapy, would be my view.
Mm.
This is a terribly important thing. So I think another change in therapy is that now in the more advanced therapies, we certainly monitor whether it's working at the beginning and the end, but there's increasing move to session by session. Just a couple of questions. Do you feel any better today? Could it have gone better? Which, of course, is a bit scary, as a therapist might say. Well, no, I think that wasn't very good. But you can then pick up people who are declining in their performance, like yourself, much earlier. In my day, when I first did psychotherapy training, we just saw them for a year and hoped they got better. Sometimes they didn't come back. Whereas now, you can monitor that if after three or four sessions things are going down. You can say, oh, let's have a look at that. So in adult therapy, there's something called increasing access to psychological therapies.
Mm-hmm.
There's one area where they were getting only, because they were doing this, they were getting 40% recovery from depression, when your target is 50% recovery. Mm-hmm. They got them together, it turned out they were, people saying, well, I feel a bit better. And they're saying, fine, I've got a long waiting list, off you go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then they said, actually, you need to do another one or two sessions. They're now up to 60% recovery in that part of that county outside London. So I think that's an exciting modern development that you can measure what you're doing. I remember once in one parenting program, I did this and the father said, too much sizzle and not enough steak after the meeting. So next time I'm jolly well mate and do lots of role plays rather than just talking, and it helps.
Mm.
Got better feedback the next time.
So it's more collaborative, really.
It's more collaborative, yeah. And it's not saying I am an invulnerable expert.
Mm. Stephen, you're the chair of ACAM.
Yeah.
For those who aren't fully familiar with ACAM's work, can you give an overview of what ACAM is and what it does?
Sure. Well, it was founded maybe 70 years ago and had a journal going for 60 years as an association of people working in the field. And this is in the days before the internet or cheaper rail fares, to keep in touch with this other and find out what works. So they had meetings and they published a journal. And really, that's what we continue doing. Our journal is arguably the best in the world. It's got a very high impact factor and it publishes more articles than its rival, and it's a very high standard. But we also have a practice journal which is called Child No Less Than Mental Health, which is for practitioners to learn what good practice is. And then we have a thing called The Bridge, which disseminates and summarises in briefly articles which goes out not only to members but to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the publication side. And the other side is having events and meetings where we get great speakers, sometimes internationally, to come and talk about what's what, the new research, what seems to work.
Stephen, children's mental health is much more in the public domain than ever before. How do you think the NHS is coping with demand?
I think it's coping badly because there is much more demand than there is funding. I was mentioning earlier for outpatient services, something like £50 per case of the total population per year.
Mm.
So that just isn't enough and expectations are rising. People are becoming much more aware of mental health now, particularly bullying, anxiety and depression. And so the referrals are going up. We're hoping that this government green paper that we were just talking about in schools will help that. But of course, when three quarters of people are not getting any treatment at all, it could have the counter effect that to begin with, you get more referrals rather than fewer referrals. So that's a worry. So I think we need to keep chipping away. Mental health is supposed to have parity of esteem with physical health. That's a bit unrealistic, I think. It sounds nice, but actually, if I'm run over and I'm bleeding, I think probably would want physical help before I want
mental health.
But we do need to keep on making it more important. And I think there's an issue whether the NHS is going to pay for that. Should a charity pay for that? Should an insurance company? It's a problem.
Mm.
So we need to keep going at it, we need to keep hammering. It's been great that the young royals, you know, the Duchess of Cambridge and people have been part of mental health. There's an initiative called Heads Together where they put mental health in schools, and people like Prince Harry is interested in PTSD and veterans who've been in our wars and so on.
Should there be more resources made available for mental health?
There should, I think so. Yeah. But of course, that means more taxation, which might not be politically acceptable. Mm. Discussed. Yeah.
We've talked about mental health being more in the public conscience. What opportunities does this open up for ACAM?
Well, I think our charitable objects are to not just disseminate knowledge for professionals, to make children better, so we've been thinking about that. So we think we need to get out there and tell people about evidence-based practice. I was saying to you earlier that a lot of people just didn't know that you can measure relationships. You kind of think, well, I know what a good relationship is, or I know what's good for people. The fact that there's an awful lot of experience out there about what works and what doesn't is really important. So this increasing public awareness gives us the opportunity to go and make presentations to government committees, to try and speak on the radio if there's a program or the TV. We need to get out there and disseminate, because I think we feel we stand for the right answer, for good evidence, not for wacky theories. And we've perhaps been hiding our lights, whatever it is, behind a bushel, whatever the expression is. Because you get busy, you see clinical cases, research, do research, you don't get out there and tell them, gosh, we've got some good news here, you know, we've got things that can help distress. Because after all, even in physical health, in the end, you want people to be happy. It isn't very good just having a perfectly straight leg if you're having a miserable life and not going out to work. So I think we've got a good argument to make. We're not trying to increase smoking or cut down more forest to grow beef. So I think we probably need better lobbying
and
skills.
Will you be disseminating information to the public as well? You've talked about
Well, we're trying to go that way, to professionals and the public. We're talking about that. We've got some great staff. We've got a marketing manager who's very keen on digital and getting things out online, and we're getting quite a lot of hits that way. We recently had a guy called Tony Atwood, who's an autism specialist, talking in Sheffield. We had a very large turnout with the majority of people live streaming it. So I think that's good. And people said it was just good value. We're really interested in getting a balanced view rather than one particular person's idiosyncratic, sometimes quackish view of what works.
You've mentioned the ACAM journals. The Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, the JCPP, is celebrating 60 years this year. And the other, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Journal, will be 25 in 2020. As a past editor, what are your memories of this time and how have things changed?
Gosh. My memories are that things are getting more international now than they used to be. It's still dominated by American and UK and British-speaking resort, but there's much more now coming from China and from India. Because you know, that's where the majority of the world's population lives. How do you adapt interventions to do that? I think I was saying earlier, the brain is coming in big time. Everybody loves a good brain. And hormones and stress are coming in much more. And the big, huge difference is genetics, that you could have a genetic contribution to something, which I was saying earlier is like, it's rather shocked me that it could be true. But it is true. So let me give you an example. It is a very controversial example. Is IQ has quite a high heritability, however you're raised. But if you think everybody's the same, and then you have all this stuff about selective schools, selective universities, people don't like to hear it. It's okay if it's athletic prowess or musical playing ability. But intellectual ability? Ouch. But that's what the evidence is. So I think we need to have more and more discussions about what is genetic, what isn't, and how we can help everybody achieve their potential.
Why do you think people are sort of squeamish about the academic?
I think they're squeamish because they like to think everybody from all backgrounds should have absolutely equal access to, let us say, for example, top universities, even if it's an objective test to get into them. I mean, that's why it is a very controversial area.
Stephen, is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked, or as a takeaway message for those listening or watching our conversation today?
No, I think be proud of yourself if you're a practitioner or researcher and go out there and tell people what you've got. Things aren't going to get better unless you militate for it.
Stephen, thank you ever so much. To learn more about Professor Stephen Scott and his research and the work of ACAM, visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.